Jones versus Palladino, Mr. Hanley.
May it please the court, my name is Patrick Hanley, and I'm appearing here today on behalf of the appellant Monica Isles. I'd like to save 1 minute for rebuttal. Because of the time constraints, I will confine my comments today to what I believe is the most significant argument that I've made in my brief, and that is, did the lower court abuse its discretion when it admitted into evidence the prior convictions of appellant Isles and an individual named James Wardell on the basis that those convictions were inextricably related to the facts in the case? There were two convictions involved. One related to Mrs. Isles. It was a conspiracy to defraud the government and investors in connection with a tax fraud scheme that occurred roughly 8 years prior to the facts in this case.
Mr. Hanley, as I understand the government's position on this, it seems to me they're resting more on the inextricably related idea than they are on the existence of one of the particular exceptions under 404B, knowledge or what have you. And they're basically saying when Ms. Isles says to the investors, "I'm really experienced in this industry," and omits the second half of that thought, which is, "and the reason is that I've defrauded people before," you know, most investors are going to think a claim of experience refers to legitimate experience, so that there's a material omission made based on what she knows to be true. And I'm not sure whether you're saying that in this context omissions never count, or whether you're saying that that omission isn't a material one.
Well, the government actually is saying that Mrs. Isles intentionally omitted to tell investors about her conviction and the conviction of...
Exactly. Well, let's just focus for the moment on hers, because I guess they are maybe making something about Wardell, but your point is probably strongest with respect to hers. She does say things, you know, to indicate that she's experienced, and I guess I'm just interested in whether you think omissions count at all in this circumstance, because if omissions count, this is pretty significant. It certainly puts a different cast on the experience, right?
Well, I'm not saying that omissions can't count in some situations. Certainly I'm not trying to say that.
Okay.
I just don't believe that in view of her representations that were primarily about the other co-conspirators, Wardell in particular, not herself, that these omissions are not material and certainly not integral to the facts in this case.
Wardell had an SEC bar also, didn't he?
21 years previously.
Well, but those are for life. I mean, they don't expire, do they?
Well, there's no evidence that Mrs. Isles was aware of that fact. There is no evidence in this record that Mrs. Isles was ever aware of James Wardell's prior conviction or SEC bar.
Right. And I think that's where your stronger argument is, because she clearly knew what her situation was.
Well,
and she held herself out as an expert.
Oh, I don't believe that. I don't believe the record supports that statement, Your Honor. The government tries to say that Isles told investors that both she and Wardell were reputable. I don't believe the record supports that point of view.
But she was their principal contact.
Well, the government tries to say that when you review the evidence of the investors. Half the investors that testified didn't even speak to Isles prior to investing. She was, in fact, the primary contact point if they wanted information about what was occurring. She certainly was involved with respect to the lulling aspects of the scheme. There's no question about that.
Okay.
But what I think this case represents, Your Honors, is the government's efforts to push the envelope on the inextricably related concept. It takes it too far. Certainly, there are good reasons for the general rule that convictions shouldn't come in because of the threat of convicting innocent people who just happen to have a prior felony conviction. Here, the government introduces evidence of her conviction as well as an unindicted co-conspirator, a conviction more than 20 years old, and there's no evidence that she's even aware of it. I believe this conduct, if it is affirmed, creates the possibility that more innocent people will be convicted, not because of the facts, but because they simply have a prior felony conviction.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Hanley. Mr. Levinson?
Your Honors, Michael Levinson on behalf of Frank Pites. Judge, I'd like to confine my comments to the Booker issue and actually the third prong of the Booker issue, which was recently brought into this case, and why Mr. Pites should be resentenced in this case.
Now, Mr. Pites made an Apprendi objection to one of the enhancements, is that correct?
There was an Apprendi objection with regard to the wire fraud. With regard to the entire sentencing issue, we feel that he should be resentenced because the judge, it's not a question of whether or not his sentence would be lower, but it's a question of whether or not the judge should have considered other factors.
Well, the reason I'm asking is because in many of the cases, not only that we're going to hear today, but that we hear that are coming up at the moment, people did not make an objection at the district court level that triggered this concern, whether they called it Apprendi or whether they called it Sixth Amendment or whether they called it whatever they called it, but something to put it on the table. And if he did make an Apprendi objection, you get a better standard of review. If he did not, then, as the government has argued, you're under plain error, and we have a much more difficult task of figuring out whether the four elements of plain error have been satisfied.
Well, I think Mr. Pites is under the plain error standard, and I'd like to address the plain error, the third prong of the plain error, that the government's position appears to be that it's whether or not Mr. Pites would receive a lower sentence. And in the situation that we have here with Booker and discretionary sentencing, it's impossible to tell what the judge would do, but we do know that the judge would have to consider additional factors. And in Mr. Pites' case, specifically, he was cut out of the conspiracy in 1996. The government concedes that. The conspiracy continued until May of 1997.
Wait a minute. The government doesn't fully concede that he withdrew from the conspiracy. We do have the evidence that he was cut out, as you have argued, rather dramatically. But your argument is that the district judge was not free to take that into account under the guidelines and might if there were a resentencing?
Correct. It specifically, I believe, affected the monetary loss, that the fact that there was $11 million loss in this case. However, Mr. Pites was cut out of the conspiracy before that total loss was realized, that there was an enhancement for affecting a financial institute. The interpleader and the fake letters to lull investors were not sent out, I believe, until 1997. He was properly charged with those under the guidelines, but now the court could consider whether or not they would want to reduce some of those points because he was cut out of the conspiracy and directly taking these actions. In addition, the role in the offense, he was a manager and an organizer at some point, but for a good portion of the conspiracy, he was not. And now,
so you're just thinking that maybe a more finely tuned approach is possible without the rigidities of the guidelines. How about the fourth factor, though, of plain error? That, you know, is there something so outrageous about his sentence that we should say, you know, the integrity of the judicial system altogether is impugned by it?
Well, prior, under the guidelines, the court was forced to use these guidelines, was prevented under Seventh Circuit precedent from considering these factors. And that is the substantial effect that it has on the sentencing. And this is also how it, Mr. Pites' case is different from the Hernandez case, the 11th Circuit case, in that it's not a run-of-the-mill drug case where 30,000 tablets under the guidelines is going to be the same 30,000 tablets. And there's not going to be a change in facts that the court is going to consider. In Mr. Pites' case, the court will be able to consider additional facts that it was not able to consider. It would not be able to reduce or depart downward because he was cut out of the... Well, he wasn't cut out of the conspiracy, but he had a lesser role after 1996. And the court can now consider that. And that's all on the record in Mr. Peitz's case. And that's how it's different than, I think, some other cases that the government has cited, and different certainly from Pittman and Schaefer, and different from Cotton. Mr. Peitz is not seeking to keep out certain evidence from sentencing, and not trying to keep out a quantity of drugs because it was only proven that it was 5 kilos instead of a much larger amount. Mr. Peitz is actually seeking to have more factors considered in his sentence.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Robinson. Mr. Blagan?
Good morning, Your Honors. Patrick Blagan on behalf of the appellant Robert Palladino. I'm going to address two issues, Mr. Palladino's doctrine of completeness objection, as well as Booker for the remaining defendants. This was a fraud scheme involving investors who were duped by outrageous promises of returns on their investment, as well as that their money would be kept safe and there was no chance that they would lose it. The key questions for Mr. Palladino and his entire defense and the entire prosecution of him was based on knowledge. And the knowledge came down to two key areas. One, did he know that the investors had been duped, lied to about the investment returns? And two, did he know that the money that he participated in moving around from account to account or spending sometimes, did he know that money was the investors' money, or did he think it was money resulting from these trades that were supposed to be made? There was no direct evidence against Mr. Palladino on either of those topics, and limited circumstantial evidence at best. The direct evidence the government did have was a deposition Mr. Palladino had given to the SEC some years before the criminal prosecution. And in admitting that deposition, the government redacted certain portions of his testimony, and the district court permitted those redactions in what we submit was a clear violation of Rule 106. And there are two dramatic
things. Now, wasn't he permitted when he testified to refer to the deposition and restore the missing passages?
Are you speaking of his testimony in the criminal case?
Yes.
Yes. Well, it's our position that
he
was...
Oh, was he or not?
Yes, he was.
Yeah.
Of course. He testified to whatever he wanted to.
Well, that's what I was wondering about, too. Why wasn't... I mean, once he chooses to take the stand, why wouldn't the various edits of the deposition become, even if they were error, completely harmless because he was able to clarify the state of his knowledge when he learned things, you know, whether he thought it was the investor's money or somebody else's money, all of those points that you're making? And I guess the other thing, while I'm at it, that you might address, I mean, you dismiss as sort of trivial the district judge's Bruton concerns, but he does mention this as a point, and it's a significant issue in a multi-defendant trial.
I'll address those in turn, Judge. First of all, it's our position, as we say in our brief, that he was effectively forced to testify by the district court's admission.
Was he not planning to testify?
That is not part of the record, and we weren't his trial counsel, so I'd have to go outside the
record. Well, if you want to make this argument, wouldn't you have to have argued to the judge, you know, that your client, Palladino, did not want to testify and therefore was forced to? I mean, you argue he was forced to, but couldn't that have been presented to the judge for a finding?
I think it was presented in the best way it could. It was the district court itself which raised the issue that Palladino could testify to resolve these concerns, and his lawyer
Did his lawyer say to the judge he doesn't want to testify?
His lawyer said he's not required to testify.
He's not required to testify. But did the lawyer say he wasn't planning to testify?
His lawyer never said that to the district court, no. What he did say, though, was that, Judge, he's not required to testify.
Yes, we know that. That's not the point. The point is, if he was going to testify anyway, then as Judge Wood said, not only is this harmless, the government's tactic would have backfired because he'd get up and say, look what the government did to my deposition. They cropped it. They obviously don't have a case. So if he was planning to testify, he wasn't hurt by this. But if he wasn't planning to testify, then he may have been hurt. So isn't that a critical question, whether he's planning to testify?
I think it's an important question, Judge. I don't think it's determinative, though, because of this court's precedent, which has warned district court judges about the dangers inherent in Rule 106 rulings. That is, that this is the kind of ruling cutting somebody's answer.
No, I understand. I think he was wrong to do it. But on the other hand, if Palladino would have testified anyway, I don't see what the harm was.
Well, I think you can determine from this record that no one would have had him testify had the SEC deposition not come in.
Why is that?
Because the evidence of his knowledge was almost entirely lacking. The government argued this case based on...
Well, that wouldn't be a reason why he wouldn't testify.
Well, with all due respect, of course it would. Mm-hmm. It would. He got hamstrung because when he testified, his other defendants had already testified.
Are you saying that if the government had not added in the deposition, suppose it put the entire deposition in as evidence, that he would not have testified? Answer my question.
I hadn't considered that, Judge, but no, because he said essentially the same thing that he said during the deposition. So no, he wouldn't have testified. And if the deposition had stayed out completely, as it should have under Rule 106 concerns, if they couldn't be comported with Bruton, then of course he wouldn't have testified because the government would have lacked any evidence of his, certainly direct and very little circumstantial evidence of his knowledge. To return to the Bruton issue, Judge.
Which you've just agreed is raised to a certain degree by this deposition.
It is, but I think there's two reasons why you can determine that that wasn't the district judge's primary concern and that those could have been fixed.
Well, so what if it was a secondary concern? Doesn't it still count?
It does, but it could have been fixed in the same manner that it was throughout the rest of the deposition. His deposition was redacted to comport with Bruton even in the parts that came in. People's names were redacted. She told me this was redacted. They could have done that with the rest of the deposition transcript, and it shouldn't have been Palladino's trial counsel's burden to redact his own deposition to comport with Burton. That's not his responsibility. That's his co-defendant's or the judge's responsibility. And a lot of times the government takes on that responsibility. What happened here was the government literally struck answers in half, taking out the favorable parts, and the district judge became somewhat troubled by that, thinking that Palladino was trying to bootstrap in his own evidence into the government's case. Rule 106 says that's entirely permissible. And here, I submit it was error. Moving on to Booker, I'm going to address that for all the defendants, save for Mr. Peitz. First of all, we took the position briefly in our supplemental brief that we shouldn't have to face plain error because of the rulings this court had previously made about whether Apprendi applied to the guidelines. This court had said that it's a frivolous argument, and the fact that we didn't raise it, therefore, we shouldn't have to face plain error. If we do have to face plain error, I think we can meet it. It's obviously error that was plain. The government doesn't dispute that.
The part of the plain error test I would like you to focus on is the fourth part, because if we assume the first three parts are satisfied, is it error, does it affect rights, et cetera? Let's suppose you can do that. What about the fourth part, though?
I think the fourth part is easily met. The integrity of the judicial process was impugned because a serious constitutional right, the Sixth Amendment that we now know is the Sixth Amendment right to have facts that affect the sentence or increase the sentence proven to a jury, was violated. And that is a serious issue that impugns the fairness of the process, the integrity of the process, and the public's perception of the process. And that's what...
If that's right, though, then why in that concluding or so paragraph of his opinion on remedy did Justice Breyer not say something like what you just said? Why didn't he say... There's now this constitutional dimension to these things, and when the courts review under plain error, they will typically be remanding cases for resentencing. Something, I mean, some clue, instead of just this, we expect that plain error will apply.
Well, I don't know why Justice Breyer didn't say it, but Justice Stevens certainly made plain his opinion that it was a Sixth Amendment violation of serious nature.
But Justice Stevens didn't prevail on the remedy part.
That's true.
So.
I don't know why Justice Breyer didn't say that. I do know that he said that not every case will result in reversal, but then they did reverse Booker. And Booker hadn't raised it in the district
court. That may be your strongest point. Look at what they
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Bleegan. Mr. Singleton?
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Jeff Singdalson, counsel for the United States. I'd like to begin by addressing Defendant Isle's argument that the district court committed reversible error in admitting her prior conviction and her SEC bar order. We believe the evidence was properly admitted both under this court's inextricably interrelated to the offense doctrine and under Rule 404B.
And why don't you review with us your best evidence that she made certain representations about her abilities and her reputation in the area? Because counsel pointed out that at least half of the investors did not have such a conversation with her.
Well, I'll put this out. Your Honor. Often she was working through a broker that was then relaying information on to investors. So I'm not sure whether he was referring to that fact. There were investors with whom she had little or no direct contact. But with a number of the investors with whom she did have contact, she did make representations about her prior experience, particularly with regard to the Lennox program in Wardell and as to these particular types of programs. We cite in our brief as an example the transcript page 422, in which she says that she's been associated with Wardell and involved in a couple of these programs, and they've been successful. I would also cite to transcript pages 507, stipulation in which it was read that Robert Dettor, if he would testify, would state that Isles stated that she had been associated with Lennox and Wardell for some time. Isles told Dettor that she and Lennox had been very successful in this type of business in the past. And then I would also cite, Your Honors, to transcript page 1657, another stipulation, this without the testimony of Ryan Oakley, if he had been called to testify. And in this context, Isles represented that she'd worked with Lennox for a number of years.
Is it your view that any person in the investment business who has been convicted of fraud is required to disclose that to prospective customers? That, of course, would end these people's business, right? And if you'd been convicted, you could never be in the. Even if you hadn't been barred from the securities business, as a practical matter, you couldn't be in it. If you had wear this, you know, sign around your
Scarlet F.
Right.
I'm not sure, Your Honor, that in every case it would be necessary. There are issues about how long ago it was. There are issues about other factors related to it.
Now that you say that, though, I mean, I get back to this omission idea that I was trying to pursue before, because putting to one side whether you can use 404B here, your theory really has to be that she had some duty somehow of disclosing to anyone with whom she was dealing in the present what her history had been in this industry. Now, the SEC order may have imposed such a duty on her, but the fraud conviction alone suggests that you really do think what Judge Posner said is the case, that once you have a fraud conviction, henceforth and forevermore, when you deal with people in any kind of fiduciary capacity or securities-related capacity, you have to say, by the way, I've been convicted of fraud in the past. And where does that duty come from?
Well, I think if there is such a duty, it comes from the duty of fair play in the securities law, the duty to disclose material information that would be important to an investor in making the investment decision. I think in this case that you don't necessarily, well, two things. One is part of the inextricably intertwined doctrine is that it tends to prove an element of the charged crime. In this case, in particular, Defendant Isles specifically acknowledged and admitted to the SEC and to the postal inspector, Mr. Lenhard, that she made a conscious decision not to disclose this information, even though she realized that it was material that the investors would want to know about, and even though she believed that she had an obligation to disclose it. But that she made a conscious decision.
Yes, but I understand. So that's part of your 404B argument. I don't understand this inextricable stuff. I thought that was just about how you had to give the jury enough information about the context so that they wouldn't be puzzled. And they wouldn't be puzzled if there were no reference to her prior conviction, would there?
With respect to I think it is broader than that, just not that it goes to more than simply that the jury not be puzzled. I think it is relevant to sort of filling out the nature of the offense.
I don't get that.
Part of the offense here was...
That's mush.
Part of the offense here, Your Honor, was convincing these defendants to trust Defendant Isles and her representations. That was done in a wide variety of ways, including representations about the security.
But either this failure to disclose her prior conviction was itself fraudulent, or it wasn't. And if it was fraudulent and you know, material and so on, then it's evidence. It's not context. I don't get that.
Fair enough, Your Honor. I mean, as I was attempting to point out, it was evidence of a fraud in this case because she had a conscious decision to deceive investors by not disclosing this to them. That's the significance of her admission to the postal inspector Lenhart, and that's on trans.
Anybody who's been convicted of fraud is going to be conscious of that. And if she doesn't tell the new investors that, so it gets back to this, you know, Hester Prynne issue, that you're really saying that if you've ever been convicted, or I suppose if you've ever been accused of misconduct or, you know, any kind of anything that has cast doubt on your probity, you'd be required to disclose or else you can be prosecuted.
In this case, I believe, Your Honor, went further than that. She thought she had an obligation to do it, and she consciously decided not to do it to deceive the investors about that. But in addition...
Can I move over to 404B for a minute? Because what concerns me about that, to tell you the truth, is the usual problem of drawing a line between propensity evidence and, you know, what the government always like to say, you know, knowledge and awareness and so on and so forth, because these prior convictions of Isles herself, putting Wardell to one side for the moment, you know, were pretty old, and other than saying, well, she's done it before, she's doing it again, I'm not sure what else you're getting out of these convictions. And in the bar.
Well, the bar, I think, is distinct, Your Honor. I mean, the bar said she is not allowed to engage in this industry. She's not allowed to associate with folks in the securities industry. That, I think, everyone has to disclose when they're trying to engage in the securities industry. I think that's absolutely correct. And having disclosed that coming in, I'm not sure that the additional of the conviction...
To talk about disclosure is odd. You're saying she's barred from doing this. What is disclosure at? Supposed to tell someone I'm not allowed to do this?
I'm not allowed to do this, but I'm doing it anyway, and so if you want to give me your millions of dollars, you know, write the check now.
Exactly, Your Honor. I mean, I understand that no one would disclose it under the circumstances in which they're trying to commit a fraud, but that doesn't make their failure to disclose it less fraudulent.
But let me stick in with this for a minute. What's the evidence that she knew about Wardell's criminal record?
The evidence,
I mean, in his problem, the SEC bar order.
The evidence that she knew about Wardell's criminal record is that she, in her SEC testimony in December of 97, I believe it was, she said that she had spoken with Wardell about his SEC and IRS problems.
But he just said something really vague like, I've had my problems with them too, or words to that effect. I can't remember the exact quote, but that could mean so many things. It could mean they had investigated him on some occasion and nothing had come of it. You know, attention of various kinds from the SEC might be unwelcome, even if it doesn't result in theft convictions or bars or the like. So awfully vague.
We believe that as on an abuse of discretion standard, the judge could reasonably have concluded that she probably knew. But I don't contest Your Honor's characterization of the evidence. But I would make another point, which we make in our brief, which is part of the marketing of these this program was Wardell's experience. Isles made representations such as he'd been doing this for 30 years. Her position was she didn't have any independent knowledge about this. She was merely relaying information provided by others. She was not. This was a scheme, a joint scheme involving many individuals. They had an obligation, if that was going to be the marketing of this scheme, to say no. Defendant, you know, the traitor, the key guy here, Wardell, was sitting in jail for 7 years. In order to put that description of his 30 years of experience in context,
but of course, there's no evidence that she knew that. That he was sitting in jail for 7 years.
But the evidence wasn't admitted solely against her. It was part of the scheme as a whole.
I understand that, but that to me is the big problem. I mean, that little vague statement that was made is not, to me, it doesn't cut it. And in your brief, you say, you know, her knowing that about Wardell's conviction was irrelevant and incorrect.
Right. I mean, as I articulated, we think the judge could reasonably have concluded that she probably knew. But the reason I said I think it's not necessary that she have known is I think it is part of the overall scheme.
Why is that plausible? Why would he have told her?
Because they had a relationship with each other.
Yes, I know, but what good would it do him to tell her, by the way, I'm a jailbird?
I believe the context in which it came up, Your Honor, is her having explained her history to him. I believe,
and then
was.
He says he's had his problems too. Now, why would he go further and say I've had worse problems than you?
Well, Your Honor, if they had a close relationship, I have a different.
They're crooks, right? So, what? Why do you think they have a close relationship? So they're candid with each other. This is part of your experience with criminals.
I can't, Your Honor. I think they may well have had a relationship in which they were candid about this issue. But yes.
I mean, you'd almost
pretty speculative.
Yeah, you'd almost be better off arguing that when she goes into business with someone and they make such a statement, that she had some obligation to follow up to find out what that meant, but that's not your position.
My position is that part of the marketing of the entire scheme was Wardell's experience. His criminality, the time he spent in jail, is relevant to putting that in context, showing that it's not accurate, and that her knowing that he had problems in the past, her failure to, as you say, to explore that is evidence of her intentional disregard of the truth of what was being said, or rather the falsity of what was being said across the board.
But you don't make that argument in your brief.
I make the argument that it is relevant to the overall scheme.
Right.
But I don't make the second point that Your Honor has made expressly. That's correct.
You don't argue harmless error either, do you?
Your Honor, I think this portion is somewhat truncated, I readily admit. We state at the beginning of that argument that to prevail here, our defendant would also have to establish that this was harmless.
Wait a second. The defendant would have to establish that.
I'm sorry. No, that's fine. The error would have to be harmless. I apologize,
right,
Your Honor. And we argue that the prejudice here, particularly with regard to Wardell's conviction, was not that great. And we argued previously that there was overwhelming evidence of Isle's guilt.
Well, what about Palladino? The cropping of the deposition, which is really ridiculous. I don't understand that.
Well, Your Honor,
tactic.
Sorry.
I said it was a dumb tactic.
I believe they were trying to limit the burden.
No, they weren't. They were trying to prevent him from explaining, from giving a full answer, cutting off his answer in mid-sentence.
Certainly the one that they have emphasized in their brief has nothing to do with Bruton. And I was surprised, you know, that it wasn't. Right. I mean, no one else's name is mentioned, nothing. That's as far from Bruton as I can imagine.
Well, that is a portion of what they tried to get
well,
on
but
that.
They, but why did you do that when 106 is quite clear about, you know, you can't bring in part without bringing in the rest?
I believe that they were introducing that evidence principally to show the timing of when Palladino.
No, you wanted to introduce evidence, and then they have a right under Evidence Rule 106 to say, well, if you're going to bring that part in, you've got to bring in the rest of it, too. That's all. I mean, they were not going to initiate bringing in the second half of that sentence if you weren't going to use the deposition. I think that's clear.
I think that's correct, Your Honor.
So, Judge Posner, I mean, well, what possible gain? I mean, here you are having to argue, you know, use some of your 79-page brief, you know, on this point. instead of just letting it come in and let the jury make of it what it would.
Well, Your Honors, I mean, I don't think I'm going to convince you that should not have been edited the way it was. But any harmlessness on this point was cured by Defendant Palladino's testimony.
His argument is the only reason he hit the stand was because this came in an incomplete fashion. The court was asked to put it in context, and I cannot see what the harm is to the government for the remaining portions of the transcript to come in. It does present a fair picture. What he's saying is he would have never hit the stand if this hadn't come in. How do you address that?
Well, Your Honor, I think that's not supported by the record, contrary to defense's argument. As we know, if you look at his actual testimony, he addresses much more than those depositions. In fact, most of his testimony is addressed to other issues that called into question his knowledge and intent in this case.
That's true once he's on the stand, but maybe you should address what the Supreme Court has said about defendant. I mean, in your brief, you say, you know, life is hard. Defendants have tough choices to make, and he simply had to make that tough choice as opposed to standing on his 106 argument. I thought that was your main response to this.
Sorry, Arm. I was trying to be responsive. But, yes, I do think that's correct. He had to make a choice here. He voluntarily chose to testify. If he wanted to rest on his Rule 106 objection, then he should have declined to testify and objected and appealed on those grounds.
Then he couldn't get the rest of his deposition in, could he?
Right, and he would have had to see if that was reversible error on appeal.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Correct.
Yeah, he had to put the whole ball of wax on the 106 objection and not take the stand.
That's correct, Your Honor.
But the fact that he testified about other things once he hit the stand, I don't think that helps you, because once he takes the stand, there's an expectation from the jury that he would comment on various parts of the evidence against him. I mean, to just take the stand and narrow it and limit it to the dep, I don't think the government would have been happy with that and would have wanted to fully cross-examine it.
I understand your point. My point was slightly different, Your Honor. My point was, if you look at all the evidence that came in on the government's case about his participation in the FLP phase, the promises that were made during that, the types of evidence about folks who were involved in the FLP phase coming to him and telling him that Benson and Pites were engaged in fraud, and that's witness Paxton on page 1237. The testimony of FBI agent Michael about having approached him in May about his father's investment, in which Pites had promised that his father would receive, I believe it was double the return in 40 days, which didn't occur. His father having then shortly after that received return on that. They're having spent $400,000 plus on automobiles shortly after the money hit an account. It's just not the case, Your Honor, I don't believe, that the deposition was the sole reason or the motivating cause for him deciding to testify, even if it is the case that he had not intended to testify before the government's case was completed, or that he hadn't always intended to testify.
Let me ask you, since time is running a little short, what we should make of this fourth element of the plain error argument when, number one, as Mr. Blagan points out, the Supreme Court itself remanded for resentencing when the argument had not been preserved in the way that I assume henceforth all of these points will be preserved. And number two, when particularly as in the case of Mr. Pites, we're given specific facts and situations that the statute would have permitted the district judge to consider that the district judge was precluded from considering. Why doesn't a sentence that fails to take those things into account amount to plain error?
Well, with regard to Booker, Your Honor, I believe it wasn't treated as a plain error case. The government specifically took the position, and this court acknowledged in its Court of Appeals opinion that Booker was not a plain error.
The Supreme Court, though, certainly could have treated it. I mean, the fact is, I mean, plain error is one of those things that the court is noticing on its own anyway. And, of course, everybody knew by the time it reached the Supreme Court what the argument was. there it was. But quite a few of the courts of appeals, you know, as you well know, you know, there's been a flood of post-Booker, post-Supreme Court Booker decisions already, have been in one fashion or another, even under the plain error standard, sending cases back for resentencing, where, especially where you can sort of see tangibly where it would have made a difference in the way the district court exercised its sentencing authority.
The case was the government intentionally waived its plain error issue in Booker so that there would be a clean vehicle for the court to resolve the constitutional question. I believe that's the way the Supreme Court treated it as well. And I admit that that's not expressed in the court's opinion, but it also does not suggest in any part that it is considering it under its clear plain error standard.
What is your position on plain error? Do you think that any sentence that's within the statutory range is not plain error?
We believe that any sentence that is within
Answer
the properly calculated guidelines
Answer my
range.
Question.
Within the anywhere within
yes.
the statutory range?
Yes.
By which
Can't
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Plain error.
By which you mean the guidelines range or
no,
the statute itself?
No, the statutory.
No, that's not our position.
Okay,
our position
so
is
when is a sentence that is within the statutory range nevertheless plain error in the government's view?
If the court had gone outside of the guidelines range in a way that was not permissible, that would be plain error. I'm afraid. Why?
Yeah, that's
when the guidelines
position.
Are no longer binding, you say that going outside the guideline range.
If they had failed,
plain error per se.
Yes, because our plain error argument is that it was not error for the district court.
I'm not talking about this case. I'm talking about the government's general position with regard to plain error. Now, presumably, you have some concept of what is a plain error in the Booker regime.
Yes, Your Honor. If the district court properly applied the guidelines, understanding
is
mandatory.
There's nowhere.
Under the prior court.
You're even saying in the post-Booker era, a sentence that was that in the old days we would have said was proper under the guidelines can never be plain error. That must be your position. Even though, you know, as in, say, Mr. Palladino's case, we have all sorts of indications from the district judge that if his hands had not been tied by the guidelines, he might well have imposed a different sentence.
That is correct.
How can that be right when we are now told that the guidelines are really guidelines? They're not, shackles.
Because it's the government's position that a sentence within the guideline range is reasonable and appropriate.
But the Supreme Court has said they might not be.
Well, if this court believes that there are sentences that would fall within the guideline range that would nevertheless be unreasonable.
There have to be some such sentences in the post-Booker world, or the court would never have said that they're just guidelines.
What you're saying now is that nothing that would have been... that wouldn't have been plain error before Booker is plain error after Booker.
That is actually correct, Your Honor.
Wow.
That is the government's position.
That's completely untenable. I mean, that's preposterous,
no.
Really. Has the Justice Department thought about this, or are you just winging it?
No, Your Honor, this is the position. It is a sentence that was acceptable and would be acceptable under current law as reasonable. Now, as I said, if you believe there are sentences that are unreasonable that nevertheless fall within the guideline range, that would change the calculus. But it's government position
but
that
those
a sentence
sentences would have been affirmed in the old days. I've seen plenty of sentences under the guidelines that I thought were grossly unreasonable, but there they were. You know, they refused. You know, they were mechanical. You know, relevant conduct-driven sentences.
I understand your honor's point, but the government's position is that those will remain reasonable. I understand that we may be wrong about that. You may disagree, but that's the premise of our position: that those are reasonable under the law after Booker, and their being reasonable under the law after Booker means that that the defendant having received
well,
such a sentence is not
very,
a miscarriage
you made
of justice.
It very easy because what you said is that. Nobody who failed to preserve his, you know, Blakely Booker issue will get resentenced.
Your Honor, that's the government's position. Obviously, as individual defendants here,
the courts of appeals have disagreed with you on that.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Do you have a fallback?
Certainly, Your Honor. As we are taking
on with this ship,
we have a fallback, Your Honor. As to these individuals, the another factor that the court may want to consider is whether or not it's likely that they would receive a different sentence on remand.
So how would we ever know that?
Because the factors that the district court
there's a big difference, it seems to me, between plain error in the guilt phase and the sentencing phase. The guilt phase, it's either or. It's either guilty or not guilty. And we can say, well, you know, in all likelihood would have been the same result. I don't see how we can ever say that with a sentence, because there's always a range. And now, post-Booker, the judge has a lot of discretion. You know, he has to pay attention to the guidelines and so forth, but he's not bound by them. So how would we know in any case, unless the judge said, you know, even if there weren't any guidelines, I would sentence the person to this.
And some judges started saying things like that after Blakely was decided.
Certainly are. I think the court does not need certainty, and where a judge considered the kinds of factors the defendant is...
It's not a matter of certainty, maybe because I've never sentenced anybody, but I wouldn't have the faintest idea how a judge would react when he was told that, well, these guidelines were advisory. Now, we know that there was a lot of hostility to the guidelines among district judges. In fact, it's persisted. A lot of district judges thought that they were being forced to impose unjust sentences. So in some unknown percentage of cases, probably, judges will sentence differently. And how do we know that this isn't one? I mean, do we know whether Judge Hart was a big fan of the guidelines or hostile to the guidelines?
I don't know that specifically, Your Honor. But where he considered the types of factors they're suggesting that he would consider on remand, such as family circumstances, such as not being an active participant in the conspiracy afterwards, and still didn't sentence them as low as he had the discretion to do, I don't think that leads to any inference that he would have used his discretion to sentence lower than the range itself.
But there are a mix of facts that go into the sentencing, and we can't, because he didn't parse it out and say he was doing so many months for this aspect and so many months for this aspect. There's no way we can read his mind.
I think that may well be correct, Your Honor, but we believe that the burden rests on the defendant to establish plain error.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And is there a rebuttal from any of the... Mr. Hanley?
Very briefly, on behalf of Appellant Isles, Your Honor. The government is attempting to have it both ways here. It's attempting to use an unfair tactic by using improper prior convictions, and then it wants to come before this court and say it's harmless error. I respectfully submit, Your Honor, that the evidence against Mrs. Isles was not overwhelming. That is, in fact, established by the fact that the government used these convictions because it felt it had to in order to get a conviction. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Hanley. Mr. Levinson or Mr. Clayton?
I wanted to address one of the comments by the government that it was their position that the SEC deposition referring to Mr. Palladino having learned that the money was investor money rather than trade money was to establish when he learned that. The record is absolutely the opposite. It was certainly to establish that he had such knowledge. In fact, the government didn't even believe his SEC deposition and trial testimony of when he learned that. The government argued in its closing that he fudged on the date he learned of it in order to make his having been given a car somewhat more palatable to the jury. So I don't think that argument really goes anywhere. With regard to the government's position that the case was over, the evidence was overwhelming, I don't know if he said that here, but it's in their brief. Reading the government's closing arguments is enough to convince you, or should convince anybody, that the evidence was not overwhelming. The government argued that Palladino was guilty because he was a businessman, he moved money, and he lended his good name to these other people. That's it. That's what they said his role in the offense was. And they didn't even argue in their closing arguments that the evidence against Palladino was overwhelming or even strong. The circumstantial evidence that the government discussed was his father having received some, or having invested, but not having gotten the return on his investment within the time allotted, meaning he was supposed to get it in 2 months. He actually got the return on the investment. He just got it a little later than he was supposed to have gotten. So that evidence, while somewhat circumstantial evidence, certainly doesn't rise to the level of overwhelming evidence. The other incident they discussed was an FBI agent who came to the office one day. This was a fleeting visit that, in fact, they wanted to talk to Mr. Palladino Sr., the FBI, and Palladino Jr., the defendant, said, well, here's how you can get a hold of him. The government wanted to suggest that because the FBI came there, therefore Mr. Palladino must have known that, you know, there was something rotten in Denmark and therefore had knowledge. Again, only circumstantial and not terribly strong. The last thing they mentioned was the FLP phase. What he's referring to there is an enterprise they had where they were going to give loans to certain businessmen when these trades came in. But just like the normal phase of the scheme, Palladino didn't make any misrepresentations to anybody. He didn't tell anybody about any of these wild investment promises or anything like that. This was just him trying to secure loans based on the money that was coming in. With regard to Booker, I wanted to point out that as far related to the third prong of plain error.
Before you get to that, Judge Wood had asked you a question, which let me pursue it a moment. The Supreme Court in the Luce case, and I think there are some other cases, said that you can't say that a ruling on evidence forced you to testify and then say that that ruling, if erroneous, you know, meant that your right not to take the stand was violated. You have to make the difficult choice whether you're going to, you know, not testify and appeal the ruling if you're convicted, or you take the stand and you eliminate the error in the ruling, which is what he did here in effect. So do you have any response to that? That seems like a killer.
I do, Judge. In our reply brief, we addressed those issues, and I think the name of the case is Luce. One of those cases was talking about a situation where the judge had, prior to the testimony, indicated whether the government would be able to get into a certain type of evidence.
Yeah, it's a motion in limine.
Yes, and the court said that the defendant had waived that issue. That's dramatically different here. This was not an in limine ruling regarding what could happen at Palladino's testimony. This was a ruling on 106 when the judge was specifically told, when he said, you know, Palladino's free to testify, Palladino's trial counsel said, but Judge, he doesn't have to testify. He's not required to present any evidence. And the other Supreme Court case, I think it's Messanino, is obviously that's true. Defendants are faced with all sorts of difficult decisions. They shouldn't, though, be faced with Hobson's decisions. They shouldn't be forced to testify by something coming in that they then have to explain. None of those other cases that the government cited indicated or dealt with any issue where the judge let in some evidence which then the defendant had to respond to. Or, I guess they think that the defendant should have had the courage to say, well, Judge, I think you're so wrong that I'm going to give up my best shot at an acquittal, which is always at the trial level, and hope that the appellate court reverses. I think that's just far too much to ask from any defendant.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Blake. And Mr. Levinson, you didn't have anything further, or did you did?
If I could suggest to the court a situation where there would be a reason to remand for sentencing, that in the government's position is that if it was reasonable under the guidelines, that it's reasonable now. If I could suggest to the court that if there were mitigating factors in the record that could not have been considered, substantial mitigating factors in the record that could not have been considered under the guidelines but can now be considered, that would be a situation where the case should be remanded. That would exclude a lot of drug cases where we've got the drug amounts are going to be the same, or where there's a situation of its obstruction that there's no reason to remand it because obstruction was not proven beyond a reasonable doubt, because that's a fact that was present before and it's a present fact that will be present afterwards. But in situations where there was something in the record that could not have been taken into consideration but can now, that would be appropriate for resentencing.
Okay, well, thank you very much. And Mr. Levinson and Mr. Hanley, you were appointed, were you not? No, you were not?
Law
and Mr. Flagan, were you? Well, anyway, we thank you for your efforts. And we thank Mr. Singdahlson equally. And we'll move on to the next case.